The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
With the testimony of Massachusetts State Police Sergeant Yuri Bukinik out of the way, week four moved into some of the more technical testimony, including information about DNA, taillight and glass comparisons from the state crime lab, and the medical examiner who did John O'Keefe's autopsy. But before we could get into the foundation for the technical portions of the investigation, cameras were turned off and live coverage was halted as John O'Keefe's niece took the stand at the beginning of day 15. Reporters were not allowed to give live updates, but they took notes and were able to report on what was said after the testimony was over. Using the reports from multiple journalists in the room, I put together a summary. John's niece testified that her relationship with Karen Reed was sometimes dependent on the day. There were good times. They would get their hair done together, get their nails done. Karen would help her straighten her hair about once a week. Karen would attend her basketball games, soccer games, softball games, planned birthday parties like a big scavenger hunt one year, and she would stay at Karen's house with her sometimes out in Mansfield. There were other days where the niece said that she felt like Karen favored her brother, John's nephew, over her, though she said Karen and John's nephew were pretty close, and at times she felt like Karen was colder toward her than her brother. As far as the relationship between Karen and John, she said it was lighthearted in the beginning. But by the end of 2021 and early 2022, they started to argue more often, sometimes at the house, sometimes on the phone. She said the arguments would get loud, but that Karen would get upset and would be louder than John. She testified about the argument that took place in Aruba, saying that John and Karen got into an argument while they were in her and her brother's room. John had told his nephew to get off the iPad, and his niece said Karen defended him. Then the argument turned and Karen started yelling about how she saw John kissing someone else. She described Karen as really loud and very upset during that argument. Then after the argument, she says that John fell asleep in her bed for a few hours. She was asked if John rang in the new year asleep, but the niece said she couldn't really remember. She had just been dumped by her 8th grade boyfriend, so it was a bit of a crisis. She said this in a joking way, and reporters said that there were multiple laughs in the courtroom. A brief moment of levity for a child who has suffered such tremendous loss. After the Aruba trip, she said their relationship seemed to change. There was another argument sometime that January where she overheard John saying that the relationship was good, but it had run its course. And she said that John asked Karen to leave, but Karen didn't want to. John saw his niece in the other room and was upset that she had witnessed the argument. So then he told Karen, quote-unquote, more aggressively to leave, then went upstairs to the bedroom. And she said Karen followed him up there and banged on the door. She said that she could tell that there was tension in those following weeks. And Karen and John would argue maybe a couple times a week, but she said it never turned physical. She said there was one time when Karen was telling John on the phone that he needed to come home, saying that her and her brother were worried, but she said that they weren't actually worried. The night that John died, the niece said that there was a rule that she had to charge her phone in John's room at bedtime, so she had put her phone on the charger in there and then went to bed. She said she woke up around 4:30 a.m. when Karen came into the room, frantic, waking her up, telling her that John never came home, and asking her to call him from her phone. She called from her phone, but there was no answer. Karen asked her for some of the phone numbers that she didn't have so she could start calling around, for example, like Jen McCabe. She said she heard several calls, and Karen said different things at different times, like, could I have done something, or could he have been hit by a plow? Prosecutors asked her if she heard Karen say anything about, could I have hit him, and interestingly, she didn't remember that. They showed her her prior testimony from the first trial, where Karen said, maybe I hit him. It was interesting to me that she didn't remember that part, especially with that being one of the most debated statements or questions in the trial. The niece said that she had never seen Karen like that, but when Jen and Carrie got there, she said Jen was level-headed. She said that she was nervous and remembered that when Karen came back later that day, she told her and her grandfather that she felt like she was living in a nightmare. Throughout the testimony, the child referred to Karen as the defendant, which strikes me as sad because it's a very coached thing to say. Attorney David Yannetti brought this up during his short cross-examination, saying, when Karen Reed spent all this time with you, you didn't call her the defendant, right? She said no, she called her Karen. John's niece was on the stand for around an hour, and his nephew, unlike last year, wasn't called to testify this year. The jurors are said to have watched with empathetic looks on their faces as she answered questions. And when she was done, she exited the courthouse, and the prosecution's case shifted to the technical part of the investigation. And while that's usually pretty cut and dry testimony, nothing about this case is ever cut and dry. Let's start with the processing of the car and the scene for evidence. We heard through Sergeant Uri Bukinik's testimony that there were a couple of searches that were done that were documented, and there were a few that weren't. In fact, officers had even been told to just kind of drive by Fairview on the way to work and see if you happened to see anything out there of evidentiary value. No biggie. The search that MSP did was documented on February 1st, and Trooper Zachary Clark was the one that was called out to take pictures. Clark works with the State Police Crime Scene Services, and he responded to Canton PD and was met there by Proctor. He took pictures of Karen's SUV while it was there at the Sallyport, and he took friction ridge impressions, basically looking for fingerprints. Once he was done there, he went to 34 Fairview, and then he returned to Canton PD, where Trooper Paul was doing testing on Karen's SUV. He took a couple pictures during that process as well. Now, although there were other searches done, Clark said he was never called out to document any of those, just the one on February 1st. The only other involvement he really had in the case is accompanying Proctor for an interview of Colin Albert in July of 2023, a year and a half after John's death. Defense attorney David Yannetti was doing the cross of Trooper Clark, and during this cross, he asked a few big questions that caused quite a stir. Yannetti asked Trooper Clark if he joined the Norfolk CPAC unit when Lieutenant Brian Tully was the supervisor. Now remember, Tully was rehomed after the last trial. He was removed as supervisor for that unit during his internal affairs investigation and transferred to a different department and a different role. Yannetti brings this up.
So you've been there for approximately 2 years, a little bit more than 2 years.
That's correct.
And so you were there when Lieutenant Tully was removed as the supervisor of that unit, correct?
That's sustained, and folks should to disregard that.
Now, if I could request an instruction.
Jurors, pay no attention to that question or answer. That is not properly before you with this witness.
Is Lieutenant Tully still the supervisor of that unit?
Yes.
I'm going to see you at sidebar for just a minute, please.
They go to sidebar, and the jurors are supposed to ignore that they just heard about a supervisor being removed there. After they come back from sidebar, questioning continues, and Trooper Clark is asked about going with Proctor to the interview of Colin Albert. Yannetti asks if Proctor told him about his connections to the Albert family before they went. But Lally objects, and that's sustained. And then Yannetti asks this.
Did Michael Proctor reveal to you that he and Kevin Albert had socialized together by drinking alcohol in their cruiser?
Sustained in jurors, I'm going to ask you to strike that question. Disregard.
I need to be heard at sidebar.
So when it's brought up that Proctor and Kevin Albert are drinking together in his police cruiser, the objection is sustained and jurors are told to strike that. But it's like that old saying, you can't unring that bell. And when Yannetti asked to be heard at sidebar on this, the judge says she will hear him. And then we hear a hot mic moment where it sounds like Yannetti is getting called a colorful word. Listen closely.
I will hear you.
The hot mic moment had the whole world talking. Is that Judge Cannone calling Yannetti that? Sure sounded like it. And the line of questioning must have had some type of impact on the jury because reporters said that there were three jurors who were openly laughing after Yannetti brought up these issues. When they laughed, a court officer apparently walked over and stood in front of them for a moment. Evan Brent from the Massachusetts State Police testified briefly on day 15 as well. He was called out on February 3rd for the search that was done at Fairview. This is the one that actually had documentation done because Trooper Brent is the one who photographed it. This is the only search that he was called out to take pictures for. The search involved Proctor, Buchanick, DeChico, Moore, and Tully. They had shovels and were going through the snow that was on the snowbank at 34 Fairview collecting evidence. Brent said a lot of the snow had already melted at this point. And after the search at Fairview, he went to John O'Keefe's house to take pictures of the exterior of his house and his car. He said he didn't observe any damage to either. Now, the searches were questionable. The evidence collection was questionable. The ethics of some of the troopers involved is questionable. But the science is the science. So by the time we get to that part, some questions are usually able to be cleared up. But if the prosecution was hoping that the state crime lab and medical examiner were going to be able to remove any reasonable doubts and clear up any questions that the jurors may have, well, they may have another thing coming.
We'll be right back after this.
Maureen Hartnett from MSP Crime Lab took the stand on days 15 and 16, detailing her role in the analyzing of Karen Reed's SUV, looking for evidence, and documenting anything significant that she found. Interestingly, as soon as Hartnett takes the stand, Brennan asks her about responding to the Sallyport on February 2nd, 2022. She has to tell him that it was February 1st, not the 2nd. Hank has never been good with dates and times. Now, a lot of what Hartnett did, we have been over in detail in previous episodes, so I'm not going to get bogged down in the details, but there are a few really important things to note here, and a few key moments in testimony that I want to go over. The first thing that I think is notable is that Hartnett checked under and around the car for blood, and those tests were negative. There was no blood or biological material found, and that's important. That's something that you would expect to find in a pedestrian collision. There's also something else that wasn't there that I would expect to be present.
Did you find any sand or salt or any other debris in the inside portion of that taillight?
No, I did not.
I thought this was a great question. I lived in Ohio for 6 years before moving back down south, and I remember during the snow season, the salt from the treated roads would be everywhere on my car. I would expect there to be salt and sand inside the taillight housing if it were shattered while she was driving that morning and later that day, all the way to Dighton in the snow. Remember, the taillight pictures from February 1st show the taillight almost completely, like, gone. There's only one small piece of red plastic left at the top. The rest is missing. And if the whole thing is missing, how is there no salt on there? You can see in the pictures of the car that the salt is everywhere else, so how would it not be in the taillight housing? Unless, maybe, it wasn't broken that badly when she was driving it. So that evidence isn't looking so great for the prosecution, right? But there are a few things that support their theory. There are a couple of scratches on the bumper. Although without any damage to John O'Keefe's body in that area, they're still kind of hard to explain. But one thing that the Commonwealth is going to do when there's no evidence working for them is they're going to create evidence. And that's exactly what they tried to do twice during Hartnett's testimony. First, with apparent broken glass. Now, Brennan puts up a picture on the screen of the bumper and the back lift gate of the SUV. The bumper has salt and debris all over it, and there's a piece of glass that has a sticker beside it to mark it as evidence for the camera. So Brennan asks about the bumper and the stickers that are on the screen.
And those two white stickers, could you tell us what those are?
This sticker, this sticker here is marking where the apparent pieces of glass are.
Is there another sticker above, or is that?
I'm not sure. If you could close up, I'm not sure what that is. So that is another sticker, and next to that sticker are additional pieces of glass.
Those items to the right of that picture, are those pieces of glass?
Yes, I would say that's an apparent piece of glass here and this one.
But on cross, Alessi brings the picture back up and zooms in and points out that the letter is inverted in one of the pictures, meaning there aren't multiple stickers pointing to multiple pieces of glass on the car. There's one sticker on the bumper, and the top one is the reflection.
There's only one sticker, and the second sticker is merely a reflection of the first sticker, and therefore, you have doubled the stickers and you've doubled the amount of glass on the bumper. Can you see that? Can you determine that from the photo?
No. Can I see the other photo, please?
Yes.
Okay.
So if we could, Your Honor, with your permission, go to Exhibit 133.
Okay. Alessi pulls up the other picture, and again, you can see the bumper with the sticker and the reflection on the lift gate. I have to admit, the drama around this moment in court was kind of like a Columbo moment, or like a Elle Woods moment, whichever reference you want to go with. Now, the other example of creating evidence where it doesn't exist was a little more calculated and a lot more sneaky. Hartnett is talking about doing a DNA swab of the taillight housing. Now, she specifically says that she swiped the swab all around the taillight on the part that would be exposed when the taillight is intact.
So I took my collection from this upper right-hand corner, the red apparent plastic, as well from this area down here, another piece of red plastic, and then these clear apparent plastic here on the front of the taillight housing. Basically, any areas that would have been exposed when the taillight was intact.
Now remember, the DNA swab of the taillight shows DNA from John O'Keefe and two other unknown individuals, and there's male DNA detected. Now, Brennan kind of ignores the other two profiles since that doesn't work with his theory, but here's what's sneaky about what he does. He wants the jury to think that the DNA came from the cracks in the taillight. So he asked Hartnett about those areas specifically.
When you took the swab, did you run it along the brakes in the red part?
Like the edges here?
Yes, the edges.
It's possible, yes, that I collected from those edges.
Do you have a memory of what part you actually swabbed?
I remember swabbing the external areas of the taillight, those that would have been on the outside prior to any damage being done.
Hartnett doesn't seem like the sneaky type like Brennan, so I don't think that she really seems to understand what he's implying here. So she answers, but again specifies that the only places she swabbed are those that would have been exposed when the taillight was intact, as in not the cracks like he's asking. It's a sneaky move, and it's one that Alessi clears up on cross. And speaking of sneaky moves, you may remember Lally saying last year that there were pieces of microscopic taillight embedded in the sleeve of John O'Keefe's shirt. It's something that was never testified to by any witness. In fact, Hartnett testified that the clothing was brought to her by Proctor after being in the hospital floor and in the ambulance floor, and the clothing was packaged together. Chain of custody in question. And again, Hartnett described the process for removing any debris from the clothing.
I remove any large items that may be present on the item, such as apparent hairs or fibers, anything that I can pick off, I can visibly see with a pair of tweezers. Once that is done, I will do a general, I did a general debris collection where I took a large metal spatula-shaped object and scraped the clothing, or in this particular case, the sweatshirt. And any debris that came off the sweatshirt was put into a glassine fold and preserved.
Before you tried to scrape off any debris that was on the sweatshirt, could you, to your own eye, see any debris in the sweatshirt?
In this particular case, I did pick off a couple of pieces of what I termed black debris. I made no additional analysis of that item. I packaged that separately, and then the scrapings themselves, I did not make any observations of anything contained in those scrapings. So there was nothing of note that I could have put in my notes to further classify them.
Now, the reason that this is so important is that telling the jury that there were microscopic pieces of taillight embedded in the shirt is, once again, creating evidence that doesn't exist. Now, the final part of Hartnett's testimony that I think is important to discuss is what I have referred to as the little hair that could. This hair has been the topic of ongoing litigation before the last trial and has been one of the most debated pieces of evidence in both the first and second trials. Hartnett describes the apparent hair and how she collected it.
I found one apparent piece of hair on the Lexus. I collected that hair with either disposable tweezers or tweezers that had been bleached with a 10% bleach solution. I put them in a glassine envelope and then put it in a larger manila envelope.
So here's why this apparent hair has been so debated. First of all, the initial testing of the hair came back with the result of no human DNA detected. There was no root on it, and it was the only one found on the car. Now, the other issue that raises questions is how it was found there. So the hair is found on the bumper, but it's not like the flat part of the bumper. It's the vertical part toward the bottom. It's actually kind of more like the lower quarter panel. This isn't an area where John's head would have hit the car anyway, not even according to any of the theories that the prosecution has given us. But also, the car is driven from 34 Fairview to John's house that night and then parked in the garage before the snow really starts to fall hard. And it's parked in the garage for somewhere around 4.5 hours. Then it's driven to Jen McCabe's the next morning, then back to John's where it stays in the driveway for a few hours. Now, Karen and her family get the car and drive it all the way to her parents' house in Dighton where it's parked outside. Then a tow truck takes it all the way back to the Sallyport in Canton during a blizzard with average wind speed of around 16 miles per hour and wind gusts of 37 miles per hour. And all the while, this little hair somehow stays stuck to the vertical side of the slick rear quarter panel and hangs on even as the snow melts and slides off the car and down onto the floor. Now, Alessi brings up the questions about how this is possible, and during redirect, Brennan tries to kind of feed answers to the witness to explain how it could happen, asking first if water could be a conduit, and then asking if it could be an adhesive. Now, I agree that water can act as an adhesive for certain things like this. Like, think about a hair sticking to the side of the shower. But the hair on the shower wall isn't subjected to 37 mile per hour winds and blizzard conditions. So, I don't know. I guess it's up to the jury to decide what they think about it. Now, as Hartnett was wrapping up her testimony for the day, she was told that she was done and she stopped and actually asked Judge Cannone if she could clear something up and correct the record from something that she said the day before.
Hartnett, you are all set.
I wanted to correct something from the record yesterday. I wasn't sure when was appropriate to do that.
Okay. Do you recall which lawyer asked you the question?
Yes, Mr. Alessi asked me the question.
So this isn't really how it's done. If there was something that either side thought she should clear up, or if there were any questions about her testimony, it would be up to the attorney to elicit that from her when they're back up there asking her questions. So, for example, if she said something that was not correct to Alessi, then it would be up to Brennan to get up there and say, you know, is there anything you want to change, or is there anything that you think you need to correct? Basically anything to elicit that testimony. But that doesn't happen here. And once each side has finished, it's not really like legally appropriate for her to just kind of say something else about previous testimony. So after a brief sidebar, Judge Cannone lets Ms. Hartnett know that the questions are completed, so she isn't really allowed to go back and clear anything up at this point.
All right. So, Ms. Hartnett, I am going to let you step down because questions from both sides are completed.
Okay.
So, thank you, though.
I gotta say, I at least appreciate the effort, though. And she said it's something that Alessi was asking her, so I can't help but wonder if maybe she realized that he was right when he was asking about the stickers, and that one of them is a reflection of the other. But I guess we'll never know.
We'll be right back after this.
Another big piece of testimony coming from the state lab this week is the analysis of the taillight pieces. State crime lab analyst Ashley Valier took the stand on Friday, day 17, and went through a long list with a ton of item numbers. So here's the very simplified breakdown of this. These packages of taillight pieces were brought in from different times that they were collected by different groups. Now, there were two packages from the CERT team search on January 29th, two packages from the search on February 3rd with Proctor, Buchanick, Tully, DeChico, and more. And then one piece that Chief Berkowitz just happened to see from the road as he was driving by in the rain the day after that. There were two packages that have Buchanick's name on the collection bags from February 10th, and the rest from Proctor. One dated February 8th, two dated February 11th, and one dated February 18th. So the first thing that Ashley did is take each of the evidence bags and look at the pieces that were in each bag to see if they match with other pieces in that same bag. Now, there were some that had matching pieces and some that didn't. Then she took the pieces and compared them to each other, seeing what she could fit together. I spent a lot of time going over all of these item numbers and comparing what items from which searches fit what other items from what other searches. Something interesting that I found is that there are only two pieces from the CERT search that she was able to fit to the taillight. Other pieces that were able to be matched with any other pieces were all found during a search where Proctor and or Buchanick was present. Also, the final pieces that were found by Proctor in undocumented searches and were among the largest pieces of all of them. Some of those large pieces were said to have been found by Proctor literally the day after Buchanick had just been out there and found much smaller pieces. Also, both pieces that were able to fit into the piece from the CERT team search were both fit in the same general area of the taillight. And the entire rest of the taillight piece that was put together, all of those were from Proctor and Buchanick searches. Think about what that means for a moment. Picture this broken taillight and all of these pieces being put together like a puzzle to basically go over the broken taillight to kind of show where they would have been. The CERT team search that was done only has two pieces of that whole puzzle, and both of them are in the same general area. The entire rest of that taillight cover are all pieces that had Proctor or Buchanick as the person collecting them. And there's something else that's very interesting when it comes to the matching of the glass and plastic. None of the glass pieces found on the bumper of the car were able to be matched to the drinking glass that was found in the yard. But there were pieces found in the yard that did match it. Now, there was also a piece of glass that Proctor found in the road, and that didn't match the drinking glass either. It was consistent with one piece of the bumper glass, not necessarily a match, but they were able to say it's at least consistent. Now, during cross, Unetti asked about the chain of custody and who brought all of these pieces to the lab to drop them off. Lally objected to the question, which I think kind of just drew more attention to it. But the objection was overruled, and Ashley responded, it was Proctor. Now, this week, the jury also heard the results of the DNA testing when Andre Porto took the stand. Again, there were a ton of long item numbers, and it kind of made everything sound much more tedious and complicated than it needed to be, which could make it hard to follow. So I simplified all of this as well. First, the taillight. The taillight housing that Maureen Hartnett said she swabbed, the external parts of the taillight that would have been exposed when it was intact, was a mixture of three contributors, John O'Keefe, and two unknown contributors. Now, we do know that those two unknown contributors could not be Proctor or Buchanan because samples were taken from them to compare. But when the officer who actually took those buccal swabs took the stand and testified about getting those buccal swabs for them, Unetti actually asked if he was asked to take the swabs from Tully, Berkowitz, or Kevin Albert. And he said no. The implication here is clear. Those extra contributors that we don't know could be Kevin Albert, Lieutenant Tully, or Chief Berkowitz, according to the defense. The drinking glass that was found in the yard was also tested. And that also had the DNA of John O'Keefe and two unknown contributors. Now for John O'Keefe's clothing. There were stain samples that were taken from stain A, B, C, D, and E in John O'Keefe's orange t-shirt that he had on under his hoodie. All of those DNA samples came back to match John O'Keefe. Now, this isn't surprising. He had on this shirt under his hoodie, so there's no surprise that these belong to him and not anybody else. Now, as far as the hoodie goes, there were some stains that were tested that came back to only John O'Keefe, but there were also stains from John O'Keefe and one unknown contributor on multiple stains on the hoodie. As for the jeans, there were three stains that were tested that came back with the DNA of John O'Keefe and two unknown individuals. That's three different stains. There were also two other stains that were tested that came back to John O'Keefe and one unknown individual. And the unstained areas of the jeans had four contributors, John O'Keefe and three unknown individuals. John O'Keefe's shoes were also tested. The right instep of his shoe had a mix of five contributors, but because there are so many, they aren't able to narrow down if any of them belong to John O'Keefe or who they belong to. When there's that many, it's not suitable for testing. So is having these unknown DNA profiles showing up on John O'Keefe's clothing suspicious? I mean, Porto did say that there is male DNA present, and part of the defense's theory is that there was some kind of altercation and John was taken outside. Lally asked Porto about how easy it is to transfer DNA, and I think that he was hoping to clear this up as something that's common and no big deal, but I don't know that he got the answer he was necessarily looking for.
Mr. Porto, based on your training and experience and years of doing DNA testing at the lab, when it comes to samples from items of clothing, is it uncommon or common to have multiple contributors?
That depends. It can happen, but it's possible, yes.
Is it something that's a complete anomaly?
I wouldn't say so, no.
I think by asking is it common or uncommon, Lally was hoping that he would say, yeah, it's common. But I think the first lesson that they say of Attorney 101 is don't ask a question that you don't already know the answer to. So that brings us to one of the most important technical testimonies of the week, maybe of the entire trial. This week, the jury finally heard from Dr. Scorti Bello, the medical examiner who did John O'Keefe's autopsy. So medical testimony is some of the most complex, and it's also open for interpretation. Doctors come in and give their medical expertise, but these are medical opinions, and medical opinions are not concrete. For example, toward the end of 2018, I started having some lower back problems. Through 2019, it got a lot worse, and I was diagnosed by a doctor as having slight scoliosis with lower spine crooked near my sacrum joint and a ruptured disc near a nerve. I also began getting sick that year. I was diagnosed with gallbladder issues, and I had my gallbladder removed. More symptoms led to a diagnosis of polyps on my uterus, and so on and so on. I spent more than a year going to different doctors trying to figure out what was happening to me. And on Christmas Day 2019, I was admitted into ICU, forced into emergency surgery, close to death as my body was shutting down. I was in full kidney failure and didn't know it. It would be another 2 months after that before I was finally diagnosed by a different doctor with what was actually wrong with me. Stage 3B squamous cell carcinoma. I had cancer and had been misdiagnosed for so long that it had spread to stage 3. I bring that up as an example for medical opinions. The pain that I had in my back was from a cancerous tumor that was growing inside of me, but the symptoms were the same as scoliosis and a ruptured disc. I was sick because my body was being taken over by cancer, but the symptoms were the same as a bad gallbladder, and so on. Doctors can have different medical opinions about someone based on what they see, and both the prosecution and the defense want to use Dr. Scortibello's findings on what she saw to support their own theory. So let's break down each of the injuries or findings and show how each side argues that it supports their theory. First, the head injury. There's a laceration or tear in the skin that has an abrasion or scrape right above it. This is also a skull fracture in the back, and this is blunt impact injury. This is actually the primary cause of John O'Keefe's death. The prosecution argues that this is from hitting his head on quote-unquote frozen ground. The doctor agrees that this could be possible, but the defense argues that Dr. Scortibello saw no signs of dirt or grass or rocks or any kind of debris in the head wound, so it wouldn't be consistent with falling on the ground. Now, the doctor can't identify the cause of the pattern abrasions on John's arm, so the prosecution argues that they're from taillight. The defense argues that they're from Chloe, the Albert's German Shepherd. There's a laceration on John's eye and one on his nose that the prosecution says could be from a number of different things, although they don't seem to have a specific theory. And the defense says it could be from an altercation and being hit in the face. There's hemorrhaging in John's pancreas and stomach that the prosecution argues is from hypothermia, and the defense argues could be from the Lucas machine that John was hooked up to that did around 3,700 compressions during life-saving measures. And the slight ulcers can also be a sign of hypothermia, but they can also be caused by alcohol consumption and the medication that John was taking. So overall, Dr. Scortibello gives her determination of the cause and manner of John's death. Now, the cause is the disease or injury that leads to death, and the manner consists of the circumstances that led to it. There are 5 options to choose from: accidental, natural, suicide, homicide, and undetermined. But first, she gives the cause of death.
To a reasonable degree of medical certainty, did you reach a conclusion about the cause of Mr. O'Keefe's death?
Yes. The cause of death was determined to be blunt impact injuries of head and hypothermia.
You mentioned 2 different things, blunt impact and hypothermia. Was
Correct.
There a primary cause of death, in your opinion?
The blunt impact injuries of head.
Now, as far as the manner of death, like I said, the choices are homicide, suicide, natural, accidental, or undetermined. And Dr. Scortibello said the final manner of death is undetermined.
Is what we call undetermined or could not be determined. That is when the circumstances in a case are not entirely known or clear to us, and the information that we have does not support one manner of death over another. In that case, we classify the manner of death as undetermined.
So Dr. Scordibello explains that after the autopsy is done, they release a death certificate. Now, this will have the manner and the cause of death if they're known at that point. But if they don't know enough at that point to give the cause or manner of death, then they'll mark it as pending. After 90 days, if there's enough information that has been found to change that to something specific, like, for example, to homicide, then they'll do that, and then they'll release an amended death certificate, but otherwise, it'll be marked as undetermined. Now, in this case, the cause of death is blunt impact injury of the head and hypothermia, although she said that hypothermia isn't the primary cause. But for the manner, even after the 90 days, she left it undetermined. She said there's still not enough information for her to know one way or the other. Now, think about that. That's kind of a big deal for the defense, because if the medical examiner says that there's not even enough information to determine that this is a homicide, then how does that look for the Commonwealth's case? Now, that was actually decided in late April of 2022, and if you watched the first trial, you'll remember that Proctor wasn't happy about this. There's actually a text thread that was read in court during the first trial where he's talking to Trooper DeChico, and he was mad when he called Dr. Scordibello a whack job because she wouldn't rule this a homicide. So aside from the manner of death being undetermined, there were a few other major points scored for the defense during Scordibello's testimony. For example, the doctor starts to explain that someone at the hospital originally gave information about John O'Keefe being at a party. He was walking to the house and he referenced some kind of altercation or dispute that John O'Keefe was apparently in. Now, Brennan objected and it was sustained, so we didn't get to hear anything else about this altercation. Also, toward the end, Alessi made a few huge points for the defense when he had Dr. Scordibello walk through the injuries one by one. She acknowledged that she looked for signs of a motor vehicle strike to John O'Keefe's legs and lower extremities. And she said she found no evidence of any impact site, no bruising or bleeding or broken bones. Also, the right eye injury is not caused from falling back and hitting the head, but she agreed it could be consistent with a punch. The abrasion and scrape on John O'Keefe's nose is not from falling back. She couldn't determine the cause of pattern injuries on the arm, which means they could be consistent with an animal. And the determination about the manner of death, she could not determine this. And this is what Alessi said.
You were unable to reach a determination as to the manner of death of Mr. O'Keefe, correct?
That is correct.
So you have doubts about the manner of death of Mr. O'Keefe, and you consider those doubts reasonable?
Objection. Sustained.
Throwing in the reasonable doubt thing right there, pretty smart. Brennan must not have liked how well that went for the defense, because when he got back up to do redirect, he kind of began spiraling out of control. First, he brings up grand jury testimony that Alessi read from with Dr. Scordibello, and he begins kind of badgering her when asking about it. But he's doing it in a way to try to make it seem like Alessi was trying to trick the jury.
You were asked about part of your statement in the grand jury. When you provide statements, is it important to have the statement in context to understand it?
Yes.
Is it important to have a complete statement rather than just part of a statement?
Yes.
Okay, side note, of all people to get annoyed about this, Hank Brennan ain't the one. But continue.
Do you remember when he read part of your answer? It was in response to a grand juror's question?
Yes.
Brennan reads the part of the grand jury testimony that Alessi had just read, where Dr. Scordibello says that given the information that she had, she agrees that certain things could have been caused from something other than hypothermia, but she was basically giving the answer based on the information that she had.
Do you remember Attorney Alessi read you that part of your statement?
Yes.
Do you remember that you had more to that statement that was left off when he confronted you with it?
I'm sure there's more to this.
To complete your statement, you said, but in the whole context, I believe that those are signs of hypothermia and not caused. Do you remember that completion to your statement?
Sustained. You can show her the statement.
Okay.
So the rest of this is basically what he just said, that she said, given the entirety of it with a man in the snow being the information that she was given, she determined that she thought it was hypothermia. This is nothing new that wasn't already said, but Brennan tries to use this as a gotcha moment. Listen to how aggressive he gets, trying to give the impression that Alessi was somehow trying to trick the jury, even though Dr. Scordibello already said this information.
Do you remember Attorney Alessi reading part of your answer back?
Objection, Your Honor.
So I'll strike that.
You asked about your entire answer or just part of it?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Can you read the rest of the answer that you weren't given when it was read for you?
Objection, Your Honor.
So this is phrased as refreshing recollection, so follow it appropriately.
Do you now remember there was more to your answer?
Yes.
Could you share with us the rest of your answer?
Ask the appropriate questions, Mr. Warden.
Do you remember the part that was left out?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
Does it refresh your memory to the rest of your statement to the grand jury?
I'm sorry, what was your question?
After looking at this, does it refresh your memory to the rest of your statement you made to the grand jury?
Yes.
And could you share the rest of your statement with the jury, please?
I have to take those findings in the context which was presented to me. So in the case of this particular case, those hemorrhages, in the context of a body found in the snow, I believe they were due to hypothermia.
Is your answer more complete in context?
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
He's literally spiraling. And the thing is, he made such a big deal about her reading that part when she's already testified to that. So all he did was just make himself look like a spoiled brat, allegedly. But the spiraling doesn't stop there. For some reason, Brennan starts asking questions about freezer burns and asking if there were any signs that John O'Keefe had been put in a freezer. Where did that come from? Then he begins to go through a list of all the things that he's asking Dr. Scordibello if she knew before making her determination that it was undetermined on the manner of death. And this kind of backfires on him because he goes through this entire list and it's all things that are completely irrelevant to a medical examiner's opinions. I think he was potentially trying to salvage this whole thing. And he brought up all of this evidence that he says points toward Karen Reed hitting John, like all of the things about, did you know that Karen told Jen McCabe that she could have hit him or did I hit him? And all of this backfired big time because Dr. Scordibello said, yeah, she knew all that. But even knowing all of that, this huge list that he just went through, she still didn't have enough information to rule this a homicide. There's something else that came up in this testimony that was interesting to me. If you'll remember in one of the last episodes, I said something about how I thought it was so strange that Proctor didn't go to the autopsy. We heard from Trooper Connor Keefe that nobody from his unit went with him, and I thought that was so strange. Well, there were questions asked about this to Dr. Scordibello, and something strange happened. A picture is put up on the screen. Now, the picture is from the defense, and it's labeled Proctor and Keefe. And in the picture, you can see Trooper Connor Keefe. It's very clear that it's him. And then there's also a bald man standing beside him, and it looks like it could be Proctor. It looks like it could be Tully, but it's labeled Keefe and Proctor. So I saw that, and my first thought was, wait a minute. Was Proctor actually there? It would make more sense for him to be there, but Keefe said he wasn't, and there was nobody to really tell us any different. Now, there was a log where the troopers who were there had to sign in, and Brennan asked Dr. Scordibello to read that log.
Does it refresh your memory on the people who attended the autopsy?
Yes.
And who were they?
I believe one person was Mr. Keefe and the other one was Mr. Corner.
So it sounds like she says Mr. Keefe and Mr. Connor, but it was Trooper Connor Keefe and then someone else. Could it be Trooper Connor? This had me spiraling. I wanted to know who it was, because Keefe said that there was nobody else from his unit that went with him. So the very next morning, the day starts out with Brennan reading a stipulation agreed to between the parties.
And the stipulation between the parties is as follows. Now comes the Commonwealth and Karen Reed, the defendant in the above captioned matter. Both parties respectfully stipulate to the following. The two Massachusetts State Police troopers present at the autopsy conducted by the medical examiner, Dr. Scordibello, on January 31st, 2022, were Trooper Keefe and Trooper Watson. Former Trooper Michael Proctor was not present.
So the picture says Proctor, the log says Connor, and the stipulation says Watson. Totally normal, right? And with all the technical testimony out of the way, there's one other thing from this week that we have to cover. And this is the part that gets really spicy.
We'll be right back after this.
There are two issues that the judge and the attorneys dealt with this week related to the ARCA experts and the Aperture experts. Now, these are both the versions of the crash reconstructionist. Aperture is for the prosecution and ARCA is for the defense. So there's two issues from this week. One is a report that has now been changed by the prosecution's expert, and they argued over why it should or should not be allowed in. And the other is Brennan's request to have his expert continue testing and working on different things to come in and rebut ARCA's testimony. So let's break both of these down. First, let's look at the changed report and why it matters. So here's the deal with this one. Not all clocks are created equal. Both sides have looked at the clock drift issue and the data provided from all the different reports, and both sides have made conclusions about which clocks are right or wrong and by how much. Now, this includes three clocks in the Apple iPhones and the clock in the Lexus SUV. Now, the whole clock drift thing was brought up in last year's trial. It's in reports from the experts on both sides for this year's trial. It's common knowledge at this point. Everybody agrees that there is some kind of clock drift. But what they don't agree on is the interpretation of the clock drift. So the prosecution's expert, Ian Whiffen, said in his testimony that you can't just rely on one of the clocks. You have to have an analyst look at it and determine how to read or interpret that information. And both sides have done that. First, let's talk about the prosecution. So on day six, expert Ian Whiffen testifies saying that he is aware that the experts from Aperture, including Dr. Welcher, used his data when they created their report. Now, he acknowledges that Aperture used his data and that the trigger point that they have for what they say is the collision with Karen's SUV hitting John O'Keefe is listed on that report as 12, 31, and 38 seconds. Now, the problem with this for the prosecution is that during that same testimony, Ian Whiffen says that the last phone interaction that John O'Keefe has is at 12:32 and 16 seconds, which is, of course, after the time that Aperture's report says that John O'Keefe is hit by Karen Reed's car. Now, Alessi bases pretty much all of his questioning on the timeline based on this acknowledgement. Whiffen has said, yes, he's seen Aperture's report. Yes, he knows that his data is being used for that. And yes, he knows that the trigger time listed is 12:31 and 38 seconds. And yet, John O'Keefe's phone is still being used after that impact time. Now, this was a big moment for the defense, and they've based their entire strategy on the prosecution's timelines not adding up. So that's not great for the prosecution. So now, Dr. Welcher has handed in a new report saying that the trigger time now is actually 12:32 and 16 seconds, not 12:31 and 38 seconds. So now it aligns exactly to the second with Wiffen's testimony and the rest of the data. So this is brought up on day 16, and Alessi explains why Mr. Burgess said that he wanted to change his timing.
Mr. Burgess states in his own words that the reason why he is changed, that time is being changed, is to, quote, align the trigger with Mr. Wiffen's analysis. And Mr. Wiffen's analysis is based upon the extraction data from Mr. O'Keefe's phone. And I believe it's undisputed that the extraction from Mr. O'Keefe's phone occurred years ago. And the data from that has been extant, it's been available years ago. So to me, Your Honor, that basis can't be a proper basis, at particularly this stage where we are approaching the end of the trial, just literally days before the testimony of Aperture.
Alessi points out that Brennan is constantly accusing the defense of trial by ambush. And he tells Judge Cannone, this is literally what ambush is. This is the definition of ambush.
As Your Honor knows, I don't like to use hyperbolic words, but the word has been used for us, against us, ambush, ambush, ambush. If there's ever an example of an ambush, this is it.
So there's a lot of back and forth over 2 days about this, but I want to break this down on what we know based on what both sides are saying. Brennan says that he has always acknowledged there's a clock variance. He even mentioned it in his opening statements. And that's true. Like I said, neither side has disputed this clock drift. So Brennan says that the defense hired their expert by the name of DeSogra to look into Dr. Welcher's conclusions and report that was provided, including the clock drift stuff. Now, DeSogra provided a report on basically what is his rebuttal to Aperture's information. And this was all turned in before the trial started. Now, if you'll remember, DeSogra is the same one who had to do the report and kind of explain the difference on gigabits and gigabytes to their expert from Aperture. So there may already be a little bit of bad blood between them anyway. Experts can get their little egos hurt. Now, DeSogra's conclusion was that John O'Keefe's phone ran late, and because of that, the prosecution's timelines will never align. Meaning, what Wiffen is saying and what Aperture is saying don't line up, even with their variance of the clock drift. And he explained how he came to that conclusion. So the defense has based their whole strategy on this, including all of the cross-examinations that they've already done in this trial, like with Ian Wiffen and Jen McCabe and Jessica Hyde, and even deciding not to cross-examine Trooper Guarino about the data extractions that he did. But here's where things get messy, because Dr. Welcher has now turned in this new conclusion on an amended report, and it changes what he said about the time drift. He has now exactly aligned it with the phone data from John O'Keefe.
And again, I go to the bottom line that the proffered reason in Mr. Burgess's report is to align with the data on Mr. O'Keefe's phone, and then that's been around for a long time.
Alessi argues that Aperture had to have done this in response to Ian Wiffen's testimony, which they're not supposed to be watching because witnesses aren't allowed to watch testimony before they take the stand. And changing your testimony or opinions based on what someone else says is the exact reason that it's not allowed. But the issue goes far beyond violating sequestration orders. Brennan argues that Aperture looked at defense expert DeSorga's report, the one where DeSorga concluded that the time drift variance showed the prosecution's timeline would never line up. And Brennan says that Aperture just looked at that and saw that DeSorga was wrong, and that's what made them start looking further into this whole time drift thing. So they look at the Lexus SUV data and then compare it to the Waze data from John's phone, And based on that, as in based on information that they've had since October when they were hired, they were able to suddenly, now that the trial is almost over, come to a determination that they weren't able to come to before. And somehow now they're able to line up the car and phone timelines because now they figured out how to calculate the clock drift and can line it up with the phone data. There are so many issues with this. One is that Brennan contradicts himself multiple times when making his arguments here. Like, first, he says he asked the expert to review the defense's expert report.
We asked our expert to review their expert's report to see if he was accurate that the variance means that these times would never align. And that's what he did. He studied the data, he studied the ways, he studied the Lexus black box relative to the time. Doesn't change anything, doesn't change the data whatsoever, just adds to the time. What he learned from his opinion is that Mr. DeSorbo was wrong. He used information from different phones, not recognizing the items that these timelines came from and that his time estimates are wrong.
Okay, so he asks his expert to do this. But then, just about a little over a minute later, he says he was surprised to receive this report.
We received this report on May 8th. I was surprised to receive it. I welcomed it. We turned it over on May 8th. There was no delay. It's been a week now. The defense has had this information. And so this is not an attempt to align anything. While it may reconcile or identify that variance more closely, it doesn't change any data whatsoever.
Okay, so which is it? Did you ask them to do it, or are you so surprised by it? One thing Brennan mentioned in the voir dire of ARCA is that experts don't work for free. So I find it hard to believe that his expert just decided to look into this more and do some extra work and has now somehow found this formula that gives time and surprised Brennan with a report on it. Then Brennan says that his expert was looking more closely at this because he was looking at the defense expert's report and determined it was wrong, right? But the defense expert's report was in response to Aperture's report. So the defense expert says, hey, here's what I think about your report, and here's why I think it. And now they're like, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to change my report. How is that allowed? Brennan insists that nothing has changed, that the data is still the same. And that's true. It's not the data that has changed. It's his expert's interpretation of it. And that is a big deal. So unless he asks for the report to be excluded, he says it's too late for it to come in at this point. But he says if Judge Kanonu won't exclude it, then he wants to at least have a voir dire so that he can ask the expert questions about it. Now, Brennan says he shouldn't be allowed to have a voir dire on this because he has no good faith basis for it. But put this in perspective. Brennan asked for a voir dire of defense expert Dr. Russell, who has already had a voir dire and has already testified once before, and the judge granted it. Brennan asked for a voir dire of Dr. Wolf, who had already had one voir dire before and already testified once before, and the judge still granted it. Brennan asked for a voir dire of Dr. Rentschler. Same thing. Already had one, already testified, but the judge granted it. In fact, overall, the judge has granted all but one of the Commonwealth's requests for expert voir dire. But for the defense, this is now the sixth expert voir dire that they have requested, and the judge has denied every single one of them. But even though the defense has based everything on what the original report said, now the judge is allowing the change to come in. And the defense, she says, gets to cross-examine on it, which is literally just what's allowed anyway. Now for the other issue, which is probably even worse. So the defense's experts from ARCA were allowed to take a look at Dr. Welch's report and do an analysis on it and basically give a rebuttal for the defense about what Dr. Welch's conclusions are and what they think about it. Now, Brennan wants Dr. Welch to be able to basically come in and testify to his own conclusions. And even though ARCA hasn't testified, he will be able to kind of preemptively address everything that ARCA had in their original report. But here's where this one gets tricky. Brennan is asking to have Dr. Welcher basically be able to keep working on testing and analysis so that he can come back again after ARCA testifies and basically give a rebuttal to any of the new information they give. But here's why this is a problem. In order to have a rebuttal witness come testify, it has to be justified by the need to challenge evidence or testimony that was not anticipated during the initial presentation of the case. And that's not the situation here. This quote-unquote new information that ARCA is testifying to is not actually new information. This is all in response and rebuttal to Dr. Welcher's report. A rebuttal witness admissibility is supposed to be based on whether or not the testimony is genuinely rebuttal in nature. And since ARCA is responding to Dr. Welcher's report, Dr. Welcher coming back again is not what qualifies as rebuttal in nature. Unless he tries to explain this and its importance.
What Mr. Brennan proposed yesterday was a very irregular process where essentially the Commonwealth gets three bites at the apple for a problem that they caused. The problem we're talking about is Mr. Burgess changing a significant part of a timeline. Yes, there was a variance that he had, but he picked a range of the variance. He's now changing the variance.
Think of it like this. Why should Dr. Welcher need to do a bunch of testing and analysis to rebut someone who is rebutting his testing and analysis? He should be able to just confirm why his testing is trustworthy. But is it? Brennan has a pattern when it comes to experts. Instead of debating facts, he tends to go straight toward insults. He did it with Dr. Russell, he did it with Richard Green, he did it with Garrett Wing, Michael Easter, and especially with ARCA. And this is no different.
Not to get into a battle of disparagement, but our expert has found extraordinary issues in his first reviews of material. And some of those concerns lead him to need, in his opinion, to actually conduct his own tests to demonstrate the failures of these ARCA witnesses.
But here's the issue with that, though. Brennan says his expert found all these ARCA failures, and his expert is the best, etc., etc. But this is the same expert that had all of the phone data information since October and couldn't figure out the clock drift until like a week ago. And this is the same expert who didn't know the difference in gigabytes and gigabits. And based on his own misunderstanding of how it worked, had a whole report about all the information that was being withheld with Karen's SUV, which, of course, wasn't accurate. So given those big mistakes already and the fact that we've heard that his presentation relied on contested witness testimony, how reliable is this expert? And with all of those issues already, how do you expect us to think that he's capable of pointing out failures from ARCA? I guess time will tell. And although this seems to be completely out of the realm of what should be allowed, shocker, shocker, the judge allows it and says that she's going to put a limited scope on it. Now, that's still very open-ended, and I'm going to be interested to see exactly what that scope is. Because a rebuttal is allowed by prosecution, but it's limited to what the defense presents that wasn't expected during the case in chief. And if the scope isn't narrowed correctly, it could be a huge appellate issue. We're finally going into week 5 of the trial. And every day, things still get a little bit weirder, and every day, something else happens that makes me just question everything. But at least the jury has finally heard from some of the technical experts, like the medical examiner. We have more medical experts and crash reconstructionists expected to testify within the next week or so. And then the prosecution should be resting their case pretty soon. Then we'll hear what the defense has to say. Day by day, we're making it a little bit closer to the edge of this trial. Could we be getting closer to an actual answer? A verdict? An acquittal? Please not another hung jury. What will week 5 bring? Only time will tell.
My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.